is a professor in the Department of Public Health Education at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, where he's been since August 2001. Prior to that time, he was with the Center for Advanced Adolescent Health Promotion and Disease Prevention, part of a CDC prevention research program in the Department of Population and Family Health Services at Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health. He holds his doctorate in health promotion and education from the School of Public Health, South Carolina, an MBA from the Indiana University in Bloomington, and a Bachelor's of Administration in Marketing. Bob has also been part of the Society for Public Health Education Leadership, both as treasurer, as well as a trustee for advocacy and resolutions. Bob?
Thanks, Elaine. I'm glad people are here. We're at an exciting time, and when Elaine called and asked if I'd be a part of a panel to take a look at healthcare reform and how it's impacting our professions, I jumped at the chance. It's something I've been looking at for a while, and I know a lot of the people in the room are eager for a healthcare change, and so the changes that came along with the ACA is something for us all to take a look at and think about how it changes our profession. So what I'm going to spend a little time talking about is third-party reimbursement related to health education and how we might look at that as a potential. I also have no relationships to disclose. So one of the things I want to cover in my presentation is just some issues for us as a profession to consider, a health education profession. And then we're going to take a quick look at some basic terms and principles of healthcare reimbursement as it relates to our profession and the changing healthcare scene, as well as looking at some of the specific changes that will impact us more than the others, which are the shared savings and the accountable care approaches that are within the Affordable Care Act. And then finally, we're going to look at a little case study that we've been working on with in SOFI and the Coalition of Health Ed Organizations, where we're trying to look at diabetes educators, and those organizations to see how health education can fit in with diabetes educators and their care that they provide. So when you think about healthcare reform, I sort of think of an onion. When I first started looking at the ACA, there's a lot of layers to look at, and I'm hoping by the end of this we'll be kissing the onion, because we have a little bit better understanding about what we're looking at. All right, so first, what are some issues for us as a profession to consider? Well, there's the age-old dialogue we've been having in our profession about the juxtaposition of health education and health promotion. Those terms have various meanings for various audiences. In my experience as a professional, those terms mean different things to different constituencies. You know, I've talked to folks at the AMA, and health education is confusing to them. We go over to Europe with the Galway Project, and over there what we do is called health promotion. I think this is a topic that's going to be continuously be part of our dialogue as a profession, but I think at this juncture we have to pay attention to those terms and how they relate to how we go about our work and who receives us to do that work. It also relates to our approaches within health ed, where we take an individual patient education approach versus a population health approach. And in a minute, you'll see what I'm talking about, where those two approaches have some ground and some traction within healthcare reform, where there's room for both of those approaches within the reform equation. We also need to look a little bit at our academic preparation programs, where there's a balance between the process skills that we're giving our profession versus the content skills that we need to provide to our profession. And I think Elaine will probably cover some of that when she talks about all of our presentations and thinking about how the organizations can help with this. And Elaine brought this question up already. Is fee-for-service approach in line with our professional identity? And I think this is a valid question for us to consider as we think about what makes the most sense. And where are we going? Where are we going in terms of reimbursement? I've already mentioned a couple of things, but you know, your accountable care organizations, shared savings programs. One of our presenters is going to talk about a patient-centered medical home approach, and the fact that there's going to be community health teams as bundled payment pushes out into the community. All right, so what are some basic terms and principles of healthcare reimbursement, and where are we going? Well, the basic place to start is we're talking about third-party reimbursement, so everybody's on the same page. What is the third party? The first-party payer is the patient themselves. So those who are on self-pay, they are the first-party payer. Second party payer would be healthcare entities that are rendering the care, such as physicians, hospital groups, etc. And the third party is someone outside of that setting, typically insurance companies and public programs. So when we're talking about where are opportunities for health education for third party reimbursement, we're talking about strategies that places health educators in a position to be reimbursed by third party organizations as the valid approach for that healthcare delivery service. So typically in our society, we've been looking at a fee-for-service model where there's set price or set fee for specific services, and they can be self-paid, retrospective reimbursement, where it's payment rendered after services are received, and then there's typically a fee schedule for different types of services. What we're moving towards is more what we call an episode of care payment system, where there's one lump sum payment for services for a condition or for a person, and those can be captured in various ways in terms such as capitated payment systems, where it's a fixed payment per person, per time frame. It's not service-based, it's by episode or medical condition, etc. A global fee payment system, where it's a combined payment that covers multiple providers. So in the past, where you had a fee-for-service that provided X amount of dollars for X physician for X treatment, and that was the fee-for-service, a global fee payment would provide one payment that would be split up among the various providers. And then prospective payments, where it's sort of a prorated per diem or per case, per person payment. And there's other terms. So in the past, the fee-for-service model really rewarded healthcare providers for doing more. There was little incentive for them to do things better, but there was a lot of incentive for them to do more tests, to do more treatments, et cetera. So that was one of the things healthcare reform really tried to attack in terms of trying to reduce healthcare costs. So where are we going? This is where we've been. Basically, payments for services fragmented to the various providers. And the market is looking at strategies to bundle those payments. This is the first bundling, if you will, of those provided services where they're bundled in the hospital in this case. So those hospital services could be drugs, non-medical staff, facilities and equipment, physician services either in the hospital or outside the hospital that come to provide services in the hospital would all be bundled. And those teams of providers would work together to reduce the costs for delivering X care for X episode. So that's sort of a bundled payment to a single payment for an episode. And where we're going, and by the way, the intent of this is to improve incentives for outcomes. So there's reward structures for hospitals that do a good job of reducing their costs. So where we're going, this is sort of a picture of a full bundled program where as you get out into past the hospital, you get to hospital-acquired conditions, post-hospital care, and all the way out into the community. And as those bundlings happen further out, there are more and more opportunities for the kinds of activities that health educators and health promoters do. And this is where we have to be thinking about what are the ways we can communicate with those constituencies in these settings to have them understand what we bring to the party, have them understand how our professional experience can help them reduce their readmissions, recidivism, compliance with treatments, et cetera. So this is a quick schematic. If you just look at that blue line in the middle, that's the cost payment amount. And so what will happen is an episode of care would be reimbursed at that amount. And you have to imagine this is more than just one person. It's a group of people with X condition. For the extent that that hospital system, physician system, health educator, diabetes educator team can reduce costs below that blue line, they profit. So they get more funds if they do a good job. To the extent that they're not able to and they go above that blue line, they don't profit. This is an example of how they're talking about strategies for catastrophic issues where people have more costs than they might expect. They would pull those people out of the pool and pay them separately. There's a lot to work out yet in terms of reimbursement and how we're going to go about changing the healthcare finance system. And so there's a lot of experimentation that's going on in the first phases of this piece of the ACA rollout. But this gives you an idea of where the incentive lies. It's trying to reduce costs below a set episode of care accepted payment rate. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what we're trying to do within SOFI and the Coalition of National Health Ed Organizations to try to get health educators positioned within diabetes care. Just quickly, you know, in the past, health educators were allowed to sit for the Certified Diabetes Educator Exam. In 2004, their board met and they removed health education as one of the professions that could sit for becoming a diabetes educator. At that point, we had sent some letters to the various organizations requesting their participation in bringing us back into the fold. They declined at that point, and now after 5 years, we're at the table again with our positions on why it makes sense for health educators to be part of the diabetes education team. So in fall 2011 and spring 2012, we've been meeting and sending letters and having conversations with the American Diabetes Association, the American Association of Diabetes Educators, a task force that looks at the standards, which is made up of individuals from both of those organizations, and then the board that certifies diabetes educators. And those organizations have their various roles. All right, so currently, certified diabetes educators have to meet these discipline or licensure requirements. So if you look at that top list, clinical psychologist, registered nurse, occupational therapist, optometrist, pharmacist, physical therapist, physician, and podiatrist, they have to have current licensure in those professions, or dietitian, physician assistant, exercise specialist, and exercise physiologist. And then finally, the discipline that can qualify to be a diabetes educator is someone with a master's degree in social work from an accredited university. In our mind, as health educators, we look at the kinds of things that we instruct in our professional programs, and we feel we're just as or more qualified than a number of professional professions that are represented on this list. And so those are the arguments we've been providing to the various parties with the diabetes question. The other part of this, beyond just the licensure requirements, is that you have to have a minimum of 2 years professional experience within your chosen profession, and you have to have 1,000 hours of diabetes self-management education experience, basically on-field work with the diabetes community for 1,000 hours. At that point, you can become eligible to take the exam and become a certified diabetes educator. If you look at the competencies for diabetes educators, some of them look somewhat similar to the CHES competencies, if you're familiar with those, pathophysiology, epidemiology, et cetera, culturally competent, supportive care across the lifespan, teaching and learning skills, so some of the things that we talk about within certified health education specialists, self-management education, and then program and business management. So what we did is we looked at, these are just the high domains, and we looked at what's below these domains and how do they map on to health educators. And a team of us got together, and over a course of a number of meetings, we came up with what we called our crosswalk of certified diabetes educators with the CHES competencies. And this is just the first page of, I don't know how many pages there were, Elaine, probably 15 or 20 pages of those comparisons of the sub-competencies with these two professions. And what we're trying to demonstrate is the very same requirements that diabetes educators have, we have covered in some form within the health education professional preparation. I think it was pretty effective at communicating that we've done our homework and thinking through how our two professions are similar. And I think it really speaks to the kind of work that SOFI and other health ed organizations are doing to speak on the behalf of the profession. So if you're not a member of SOFI, I encourage you to become a member, because this is the kind of work that benefits you, benefits our profession, and makes the work world better for all of us. So what happened? So far, we've gotten the ADA and the task force to recognize within the National Diabetes Self-Management Education Standards that health educators do indeed have a skill set that should be considered part of the team. And so in the spring of 2012, they added health education as a profession that should be part of the team. That's just the first step, and which was a good step for us. The next step is the National Certifying Board for Diabetes Educators is meeting this fall, soon actually, and they'll be looking at our request to reinstitute health education and health educators as one of the professions that can be considered for becoming a CDE. And I think the fact that we've got the task force to include health education was very significant and essential, really, first step to making sure that they really look at our request with the diligence that we think it deserves. So we'll keep you posted. So going back to our model there, what does that mean for us? These are the levels within the diabetes world in terms of providing support for people with diabetes. So at level 4 and 5 down here, this level is for certified diabetes educators that are credentialed. Level 5 is typically in management. Moving backwards, level 3 are those people who can provide some level of diabetes education but are not diabetes educators certified, but are eligible for diabetes certification. And then level 1 and 2 are non-clinical and support staff that do other things. They can provide some diabetes education, but typically are providing other support. So they look at a team approach, and we feel that currently, without any changes, we already are eligible for level 1 and level 2 as health educators and can be reimbursed within their diabetes team. And the dotted lines refers to those areas where we think that with the recognition of health education, we can also be a part of that reimbursement process. So you saw my earlier list in terms of what we need to consider. I think the real question for us now, and the other presenters will hopefully get you thinking about this as well, is where are the opportunities for health education profession to contribute and thrive in the changing health improvement landscape? I think that's the question we need to continue to ask ourselves. And if you think about the onion, there's more than one way to slice an onion. Unfortunately, a blooming onion isn't exactly the most healthy onion, but it sure is an easy way to cook an onion. And so I want to just thank you for participating, and I mean that. I think your participation in this is required. We've got folks in Greensboro, I'm at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, that are currently meeting with our health system and working with our health system to get health educators part of their team. And they've done a great job of finding strategies to include health educators within the reimbursement model already. They're not waiting around for things to happen. They're making it happen with their local partners. And so right now, health educators are part of teams and are getting reimbursed for care that's being provided within the health system. And we're continuing to look at strategies to get it more recognized. But this is just one example. Thank you.